Local voters say they're in favor of a halfpenny tax for local schools. Jacksonville could be the most expensive city in the country to secure with a seawall. And President Trump hits Florida to kick off his reelection bid. Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good Friday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect, and I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, it's all the top stories of the week with our Friday roundtable. You can join us. Give us a call right now. It's 549-2937. Then later, today is not only the first day of summer, but it's also International Yoga Day. We'll tell you how Jacksonville is saying namaste. All of that ahead. But first this hour, it's Friday. Here to discuss a busy week in the news, we welcome Dan Scanlon of the Florida Times Union. Good morning.
Good morning.
Freelance journalist Claire Goforth is here with us.
Good morning.
Shelton Hull of Folio Weekly.
Good morning.
And radio host Angela Spears of Angela Spears Communications.
Good morning, Melissa.
Good morning to all four of you. Thanks for being here this Friday. Lots to talk about this week. Everything from a huge price tag being reported to protect Jacksonville from rising waters to the president's campaign kickoff here in Florida. We'll get to all that in a moment. But our top story right now, a new UNF poll out today says Duval County voters are in favor, showing strong support of a half-cent sales tax to pay for upgrades and repairs to local schools. The poll finding about 75% of voters support that proposed tax. 46% of voters also say they disapprove of the way the city council is handling its job. The council looks to be deferring the sales tax question. Yesterday on this program, we spoke about it with Duval County School Board Chair Lori Hershey. She says she's worried about some council members' comments about the sales tax during debate.
That this may begin to really be more about the push to privatize public education in Duval County versus public schools.
Superintendent Diana Green, meanwhile, wants the city council to put the tax on the ballot this year. She says her goal is to support all public schools.
It has been from the very beginning, the board has made it clear that there will be an opportunity for charter schools to participate or receive dollars through this half-cent sales tax if it is approved by the voters.
We're going to begin the hour with a closer look at UNF's latest poll as we take your calls at 549-2937. Give us a call. Emails go to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org and tweets to @MelissaInJax. By the way, this UNF poll also found the majority of Duval County voters support the decriminalization of marijuana and are against selling JEA. But let's start with the sales tax question. Dan Scanlon, as the city council looks to sort of punt this issue down the road, they are not in sync with the voters who really approve this tax, according to UNF's polling lab.
And the voters have kids in these schools that, as I heard yesterday from the superintendent and the chairwoman, some of these schools are being held up literally by 2x4. So I can understand that. I can also understand there is some legitimacy to, hey, let the new city council handle it. It's going to be their ball game for the next 4 years, 7 new members coming in. And there's also the concern, legitimate as well, because of the low voter turnout in the city, that if you hold a ballot only question in 2019, 10% show up the voters versus if you do it in 2020 when there's other things for them to show up to, then you get a better representation, a better vote, and maybe a better chance of passing it.
The Duval County school system, Angela, they need $1.9 billion to fund their master facility plan because Duval has some of the oldest school buildings in the state. These are crumbling buildings, some of them. Some kids are going to school in the hot months without working air conditioning much of the time. It's not a good situation for teachers and kids. As Dan pointed out, though, because the city council has been given authority over this matter, too much criticism, I might add, there's this sentiment on the council, well, let's let the new incoming members decide this. What about that?
This is something, as Dan mentioned, this is something that the voters want. This is something when you talk with parents, when you talk for those of us who don't have kids, our kids are worth it. A half cent sales tax, a half cent, our kids are definitely worth it. And this is something that we need our city council persons, to step up. And if they're going to take the heat for it, that's okay. Step up to the plate because that's what we elected you to do. And Melissa, you mentioned that the criticism of the city council being in charge of it. Yeah, the school board has done its research, right? That's what it's supposed to do. The school board has done its research. The superintendent has done her research and said, hey, this is what we need because our kids, their education should come first. We want to be that top school. Dan and I were talking about in St. John's County how, you know, their school, they're one of the top ranked schools in our state. And we want people to come here to Jacksonville, right? We continue to want to go to the next level. How are we going to get that? We have to make our schools the best place to make them top notch to want people to come here. And who wants to go to a crumbling school? Who wants to go to a school that's being held up by 2x4s? Who wants to go to a school that doesn't have internet service for our kids?
It's 549-2937. Where do you stand on a half penny tax for schools? Claire Goforth, this survey showed strong bipartisan support across Duval County. A majority of registered Democrats and Republicans are in favor of this. How do you think this will potentially affect how city council members vote on this or move on this?
Right. It definitely sends a strong message to city council that the voters of Duval County support this half cent sales tax. I did find it very interesting that the people surveyed were actually quite strategic in when they think this referendum should take place. 34% preferred November 2019, while 49%, almost half of them, preferred the general election in 2020. Well, as we all know, as Dan said earlier, you get very low turnout in these special referendums, whereas we're coming up to a presidential election year when we have turnout across the board, particularly in liberal sectors where you're seeing more support for this tax. So by making this decision and having it in 2020, it actually gives it a greater chance of passing.
This gives the school officials, Shelton Hall, more time to mobilize support for the tax and educate the public about where their money will go. It is looking increasingly like if it makes it under the ballot, it will be next year. What about that?
I think it will probably go into next year and it will probably pass. I can see the logic of wanting to hold back on this until the new council comes in, but it's been my understanding that most of the new council people coming in essentially hold the same view on the subject as their predecessors do. But as always, this is another situation with education issues where the adults are going back and forth on the subject without a lot of input and insight from the students themselves. And so it's summertime now, and I know a lot of students are probably listening, especially the nerds. And what I would suggest is in the next school year, as we move towards a vote on this thing, I would suggest that students get out there with their cell phones and start taking pictures and videos of the conditions in their schools and flood the field with this and find out who your city council person is, tweet them and send this information to them, because a lot of folks now, and this brings up the matter too, that a lot of these council people aren't spending as much time going to the schools and engaging the students and engaging the teachers as they should. So they may not even be aware of how bad conditions are in some of these places. And it's really on the students themselves to make their voices heard.
One student did give dramatic testimony at the last city council meeting, Dan Scanlon, and really moved a lot of people listening, a young female student. But we haven't heard from a lot of students yet.
Look,
as Shelton pointed out,
we have the Parkland students to show you when a tragedy hits, how they mobilize and very intelligently, as they did in Broward County and nationwide, go out and prove a point very well. Another thing, Nate Monroe's column yesterday talking about this issue brings up a point. It's estimated $6 a month is what this would cost an average family in Jacksonville if this were passed. Now, $6 a month, okay, fine. I don't get three bags of potato chips. It might work out as being economically viable, but that's a point that maybe needs to be pushed here. This will not cost the average family that much for their kids to have a better school, or maybe their grandkids, because it will take a while to build stuff.
Let's go to your calls now. It's Friday. It's the first day of summer, too, as we talk are you hot enough out there? As we talk, it's hot in here with our smoking Friday Media Roundtable, talking about all the top stories of the week. Where do you stand on a proposed half-cent sales tax for Duval schools? 549-2937. Lee is on the west side. Hi, Lee. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Okay, thanks. Go ahead.
I would like to know what's going on with the lottery. When I came back to Jacksonville, I'm a native of Jacksonville, but I moved to Alabama for a while. And when I was moving back, I heard they had started the lottery. And I also heard that this was for the school, but I've never heard it mentioned on any of the broadcasts. What's going on with the lottery? Isn't the lottery supposed to be to help the schools?
Yes, it is. And some lottery funds do go toward the state schools. Not enough if you talk to proponents of how that funding mechanism was set up. And so, you know, every time we talk about this, somebody calls in and asks about that.
Well, you know, with the lottery thing, personally, I have no idea how much of the lottery income goes towards the schools. One suggestion I might have is maybe passing legislation that says, you know, of course, when you get these big lottery jackpots and you win, that stuff is heavily taxed. I'd like to see if the taxes on lottery winnings are themselves allocated towards the schools as well.
And the proceeds from the lottery go into the state's Educational Enhancement Trust Fund. It helps pay for public education, including Bright Futures scholarships. It's about $1 billion a year that gets spread around the state. That's not a pool of money, though. This is a different pool of money. It's my understanding that the school board needs to access for school improvement.
Right. The lottery is program money. The half-cent sales tax would be facilities improvement and construction only. And that point has been brought up, obviously, by the superintendent and others. It goes to bricks and mortar.
You know, and if Jacksonville's schools need so many repairs and it's a better idea for us to wait till 2020, what's stopping city council from and the mayor from putting through a special request for funds to get put the Band-Aid on it in the short term so that next year when they can get the referendum passed, if it does, they can really start this project in earnest? And furthermore, what's stopping city council, the current city council that we have? I mean, politicians make decisions as lame ducks, as we call them, time and again, and people don't bat an eyelash. And meanwhile, they're just passing the potato to the next round of city council. What's stopping them from putting the referendum on the 2020 ballot this upcoming Tuesday?
Why can't they do that? That's a good point.
Let's go to Carol in downtown Jax. Hi, Carol. Good morning.
Hi. Yeah, I don't. If you pass it next year, doesn't a lot of that money go to charter schools by the state law that's been passed?
Some of it does, yes.
And the other thing is, I've met people that live in Ponte Vedra, did not even look at Jacksonville because of the schools.
You mean in terms of where they want to live, right?
They moved to Florida and they moved to St. John's County because Duval County had such terrible schools, even though they worked there.
Carol, thanks for that. And you know what? I know that a lot of people who move in from out of state make that decision because they perceive that Duval County has terrible schools. But the truth of the matter is that Duval County does not have terrible schools.
Right.
Duval County has a number of outstandingly good public schools. They also have some struggling and failing schools. But it's simply not accurate to say that Duval County has terrible schools. That is not true. Now, that said, that caller is absolutely right in pointing out that people tend to choose St. John's County when they're moving here from another location. And sometimes they move from Duval to St. John's County because they perceive that St. John's County schools are superior. In St. John's County, voters there overwhelmingly approved taxing themselves to pay for these kinds of school infrastructure improvements, by the way.
And Melissa, it's important to note that we are not talking about the education of the school. We're talking about the infrastructure, right? This is what this half-cent sales tax, as Dan had mentioned here, it's not about the programming. It is about simply the infrastructure and the repairs. So let's just make that clear. That's what we're talking about when we say it's in bad shape at this point.
Let's go to Jessica, downtown Jax. Hi, Jessica. Go ahead.
I'm actually really pleased to hear there's a lot of solutions that are being tossed around. I think this comes down to very impactful for the business community as well. If we're looking at buildings that are being vacant and commercial properties that are, like, for instance, Florida Times Union Building is an example. The historic building is just sitting there, and it's going in a derelict way if we do not utilize it, and it's still okay. Why can't we take the schools that are in worse condition and put them in these vacant commercial buildings, give tax incentives to the property owners, to the businesses even, temporarily speaking, so that the the schools themselves can go under construction and we can see a revitalization of the school properties. And that way we don't have to look at rebuilding or rehousing. It's just basically moving them around so that it actually creates a more continuity within the city.
Thanks, Jessica. You know, if you look around Florida, you will see charter schools in some vacant commercial buildings. And that has been actually heavily criticized because they're not always good quality structures. They don't face the same regulations and limitations that public schools do in terms of where the students are housed, what kinds of buildings. There's the public schools have to meet a higher standard. And so, proponents of increased charterization say, well, we like the flexibility of going in a different building. But so these issues are complex.
You know, it's interesting, though. St. John's County, when a developer comes in and builds a large subdivision, there have been rules set in place that they have to provide space for a school. And some of them have actually built schools. And the same there in Yulee in Nassau County. You take a look at that huge facility being built at A1A and 95. There is a school building in there right now built by the developer. So some counties are thinking ahead. If you're going to bring in the people, then you better bring in space for a school.
Laura in Jacksonville Beach. Go ahead, Laura.
Hi. My family actually moved to Duval County because of Stanton College Preparatory School. It is rated fourth in the nation, I believe. It kind of goes up and down a little bit every year. But and we've loved it. The teachers are amazing. And my kids love it. But every time it rains, their campus is a couple inches underwater that the kids have to trudge through to get to their classes because mm-hmm. some of them are in mobile units and things like that. So I would happily support a tax to pay for, you know, schools to be able to take care of their campuses so that kids don't have to do things like that.
Right, Laura, that's a perfect example of what we're talking about. That building, I think, is about 80 years old. And those types of infrastructure problems are common. And so thanks for pointing that out. Tiffany on the north side. Go ahead, Tiffany.
Hi, yes, good morning. I most certainly support the half-cent sales tax referendum. One of the things that I've highlighted when I've sat in a few of the city council meetings is that we are creating a talent pipeline for our children to pass through. And in essence, I have a daughter who's a student at Douglas Anderson School of the Arts, a son that just graduated from First Coast High School. And the buildings that they currently sit in, both of them, are in need of some major repair. But we have to keep in mind, our children, this is being played out in front of them, our juniors, our sophomores, our seniors. And if the same buildings, if we don't get these repairs done and get them done in the next couple of years, those same children that are occupying those seats, 10 or 15 years from now, they are not going to want to bring their children, in essence, my grandchildren, back to the same schools, you know, and raise their families here because of the struggles we are currently having.
Thanks for that, Tiffany. Let's take one more call on this. It's Linda in Deerwood. Go ahead, Linda.
Yes, I just want to say that, you know, even if we got creative with the city council, public-private partnership of anything, I just think the challenge is people think that Duval County schools aren't well because our legislators have helped paint that picture. St. John's touts that they are the number, you know, one school district in the area, and they sell that. It seems like our legislators have a different agenda. We need to think about the tax base and the kids and the people we want to move here and not move to St. John's County just because of the schools. We can do it if our legislators actually help us. Thank you.
Thank you for that. And here is a tweet from Jim. The Duval County School Board is the largest property owner in the county. Powerful interests would rather see those properties in private hands. Investing more in public school properties works against the real estate goal of privatization. What about that argument?
Well, these private property owners, they may have their interests, but their parents as well. We had the lady earlier who said she moved out to St. John's County because of the schools. We know that parents are willing to pay a price for their children's education. They'll approve the sales tax if it comes before. If it goes to the ballot, the parents will approve it. They'll move out to different counties that are further away and pay a higher cost of living in order to have access to better schools. They'll put their kids on buses and send them all across town in order to get access to better schools. Claire's suggestion earlier about, you know, using this to sort of boost up local construction firms, that's a great argument to be made, because the money that's spent on these renovations of schools, that goes right back into Duval County businesses, Duval County contractors and construction people, because we can't have like 2 inches of flooding water over at Stanton. We know how teenagers feel about their sneakers. And if
true.
Oh gosh.
And they feel pretty strongly.
Yeah.
This I know.
That is the kind of we've all been, that will make people very, very angry.
And I mean, enriching the construction industry is a language that Duval County speaks very fluently.
Oh yes.
Okay.
And Melissa, and it's important to note too that remember some of our schools are used as hurricane shelters. Mm-hmm. So we need them in good shape to protect the community for those who may need some place to go when we know we're often hit by those.
And don't That's forget right. the Northeast Florida Builders and Realtors Associations have both put their thumbs up to this issue on the ballot this year. So they want it.
We will continue to follow it here at 89.9, but we are going to move on now and talk about some other news and notes from the week. If you're just tuning in, it's our Friday Media Roundtable as we're taking your calls at 549-2937. And moving on, also making headlines this week, a new report published in the New York Times the other day says Jacksonville is the most expensive city in America. That is when it comes to protecting us from the effects of climate change. Now, the Center for Climate Integrity reports it will cost nearly $3.5 billion to build seawalls all around town to protect Jacksonville from rising sea levels. That's because Duval has vulnerability to both coastal and river flooding, and we are a really big, far-flung city. It's going to cost Duval more than any other city in the country to build seawalls. That's if we decide to do that. And so what are your concerns about protecting this community from rising waters? Give us a call. It's 549-2937. And so the National Center for Climate Integrity says we would need 632 miles of barriers to contain water as it comes in both at the coast and along the St. John's River and all of its tributaries.
That's Riverside, Avondale, and San Marcos, specifically along the river, because of what we remember very well, some of us, how deep it flooded during Irma, what, 2 years ago, 3 years ago now? I can't even remember, but literally destroying homes on both sides. And that's not even talking about the beach. That's talking about where people live, and at least 2 feet higher is the seawalls would have to be. And then what happens when it does rain and the outflow can't get out, which has always been an issue, especially in San Marco.
That's right. And there are a couple of committees now, a working group on flooding and a local resiliency committee that are just starting to do this work. Critics say the city's way behind the curve to figure out how Jacksonville's going to adapt to changing water levels and more heavy and more frequent storms. By the way, let me make a plug for a new website we're launching this month at WJCT that's going to be looking at all of these issues. It's called adaptflorida.org, adaptflorida.org, launching this month. If you go to that website, you can click on it to opt into updates we'll be publishing as we report on these issues. But, you know, at the same time, guys, the city council is also using federal money to buy and demolish 17 homes in the South Shores neighborhood. That's on the South Bank by St. Nicholas. Those homes are basically unsalvageable. They're built in a very low-lying area, and so they're going to clear that area of homes. What's happening in South Shores is a preview of more of this type of action we're going to be seeing in the coming years.
It's kind of sweeping the dirt under the rug. They don't need to spend money demolishing these homes. The water will do that for them. With, you know, we were talking about Riverside, Avondale, Ortigas, San Marco. These are areas that are highly vulnerable to flooding. These are some of the most valuable properties in the city. These are some of the homes where the city's elite live. And as we remember with Irma a couple years ago, even if you weren't in areas that directly flooded, wherever you lived in the city, your life was inconvenienced in terms of getting to work, getting to school. The lady earlier mentioned flooding at Stanton. I live right by the river in Riverside. Water was hip deep. Mm-hmm. I couldn't get, you know, for a quarter mile in any direction, I couldn't go up and down the river. My mom lives over by Stanton. Some of my family went over there because that's at a higher elevation. And what we're looking at now is, you know, it floods badly just with stiff rains. The fact of the matter is we were lucky that Irma wasn't a humanitarian crisis. We were lucky that we've dodged a bullet on hurricanes over the last 50 plus years. But as we've seen, now Miami is going to have a Hurricane Katrina type situation in the next 10 or 20 years. And if we ever, you know, we've dodged the bullet so far, but if we ever get a serious hurricane direct hit here in Jacksonville, every single person listening to this broadcast now is going to end up having to bury someone they care about. And it's a tragic thing. And we're talking about, you know, the big number is $3.5 billion, but it's really $50 million a year over the next 20 years.
That's right.
And we don't have to, it doesn't have to be that way.
That's right. And going beyond the really catastrophic impact of storms, there's also this slow but steady creeping impact that we're going to observe of rising waters, and the fact that this city, particularly in the older neighborhoods, doesn't have the infrastructure to handle that. And how are we going to pay for what is going to be needed?
Melissa, back in the day when we did television, you know, we were still talking about drainage and infrastructure. Remember McCoy's Creek? Mm-hmm. And it still floods because didn't the city supposedly in that area put something down and it was supposed to stop it, stop the flooding? And I don't think it has stopped the flooding.
It flooded a few weeks ago during a gully washer. If we have a high tide combined with a full moon, there are places in Mandarin that are going to flood along Julington Creek just because. And literally every time it rains heavy, I know the places to go where I'm going to be up to my ankles, knees, or worse in water. Where there are buildings, where are their homes?
What do you think of the new report showing Jacksonville will be the most expensive city in the country to protect against rising waters? Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Tom is at the beaches. Hi, Tom. Good morning.
How you doing, guys?
All right.
Thanks for taking my call. Anyway, I was just going to say there's a certain amount of risk wherever you live. And we all live in Florida because it's absolutely beautiful. And we have the river and we have the ocean. There's risk involved. And, you know, to say to spend $3.5 billion for flood mitigation, I think is beyond ridiculous. We all take risk. We all live here. We all love it. And it's just part of the risk we take to live in coastal Florida. It's a pretty simple answer. There's no reason to spend $3.5 billion to protect against the potential risk that we all face no matter where we live.
Thanks for that, Tom. And that's another argument that you're going to hear being made more and more. Why should we pay to protect people who make the voluntary choice to live or site a business in a vulnerable coastal area? You know, down in St. John's County, some homeowners down there took a case all the way to the state Supreme Court. They wanted a section of old A1A to be shored up. And I think, correct me if I'm wrong, I think they lost. Because at a certain point, the state is going to say, well, we're looking at diminishing returns here. If water is going to reclaim an area, there's going to become a tipping point in certain areas where, you know, insurers are going to say, look, we just can't insure this section anymore.
You want to see diminishing returns? Look at Flagler Beach over the past 5 or 6 years along A1A. Mm. How much of the A1A was literally carved out by ocean waves, not once but twice, and had to be repaired? And at a certain point, some are saying, just give it up to the ocean and relocate or build your homes, you know, a few hundred feet further inland so that you still have beachfront in a few years when the beach finally gets to you.
Right. And that's not a conversation we're having in this community yet, but other cities around the country are. They're already discussing managed retreat. And that can spark panic, honestly, in homeowners. Yeah. If a city starts talking about managed retreat, homeowners start to realize that they're not going to be able to sell their properties. And we're not there yet, but that is on the horizon for a lot of Florida communities.
Some of these people won't be able to sell their properties because they won't have properties left to sell. We're not talking about government handouts. We're talking about $3.5 billion spent to shore up, you know, a multi-billion dollar investment that's been made in these homes. If you paid $100,000 for your house, would you spend an extra $1,000 to make sure it's not destroyed? I think most people would.
But yet you're going to have in your mind those images of those homes hanging over waves during a storm as they're about to cave into the surf because the beachfront has been carved out. And Flagler Beach doesn't have, St. Augustine Beach does not have the beaches it did when I came here 30 years ago. They're They're cliffs now.
Yeah, that's true. I'm interested to see how the New York Times believes that this is going to be federal money. Really, it's going to be federal dollars. I think that we could all agree that in this moment, maybe there's a little bit of nostalgia for Miss Corrine Brown, because she was a very powerful member of Congress who was well known for bringing money back to Northeast Florida. If that's the case, then we're going to be looking at our representatives in Congress to start bringing this money to us, to start doing something about the fact that the sea is rising.
That's
right. We can't deny it.
This article made a point of stressing, according to the Center for Climate Integrity's numbers, that there will be winners and losers when it comes to federal funding that will be doled out for mitigation and adaptation measures. And certainly Florida is the most vulnerable of all 50 states. Yeah. But so Florida is going to get money. The question is, which there will be a fight between communities over funding and protection dollars. And is Jacksonville well positioned to get those dollars, I think, is the question that we're all asking, particularly given that we're going to be the most expensive city, according to this one study, which, you know, those numbers could change. But it's still certainly worth, it's an eye-popping number, which is why we included it in the show today.
You know, the city is just about ready to fix the county dock, which was destroyed by Irma. But they have yet to fix the front of Memorial Park with the big winged victory statue. Oh, yeah. From the damage there and the epic photos the Times Union shot of literally the water up to the base of the statue as the river came in for a block or two or three.
Okay, let's move on and talk about another big story from the week. A St. Augustine man is in the Orange County jail today. This after he reportedly assaulted a journalist from the Orlando Sentinel on Tuesday during the president's rally down in Central Florida. President Trump kicked off his reelection bid Tuesday night at the Amway Center. Meanwhile, 51-year-old Daniel Kessner was recorded spouting expletives on cell phone video recorded from a reporter at the Sentinel. Kessner tried to knock the phone out of the reporter's hand, and he was promptly carted off to jail. He was upset about being kicked out of the Amway Center where the rally was held. As we talk about the president's reelection bid, give us your thoughts at 549-2937. No accident that Trump chose Florida to launch his 2020 bid, Shelton.
That's true. You know, it's not fair to blame the president for this situation, because it's really just a case of a drunk guy who got into an argument and wasn't happy about the fact that his argument was being recorded and was about to go on the internet. But that said, I will still blame Trump, because he has, from day one, projected open hostility towards the media. He has encouraged his followers to yell at and taunt people in the media, especially CNN. And on the international stage, he's gotten very close to autocratic regimes in Russia, Philippines, North Korea, and most notably Saudi Arabia, that are openly hostile to the free press. And it's been journalism is always a very dangerous business in general. We're not used to that being so dangerous here in the United States, but as we saw with the shooting at the newsroom in Maryland last year, that is ratcheting up. And the president's rhetoric has done nothing to help the situation.
And I agree with that. It doesn't help that Trump constantly calls the media the enemy of the people and saying all these negative things when reporters are doing their job. The job is to speak truth to power, right? That's their job, is to tell stories. And when they're doing that, it doesn't help. And people are seeing, and some of the people who go to these rallies, they're feeding into this, like, yeah, the media, they're bad, bad, bad. And you know what? Members of the media are not bad. They're doing their job. And you see it coming. And I just see it's going to continue. Possibly it gets worse. Joe Scarborough is writing a book. He wrote a book. It's coming out later this year, saying this ends badly. And, you know, somebody, you know, has to talk to the president, talk with his team, that this is language that has to end. The journalists, they have, they're protected by the Constitution.
I mean, you may as well talk to a brick wall.
I know. I was just putting it out there that hopefully somebody would listen and maybe talk with him, talk with his staff, talk with somebody. That this has to end, because you can't go around talking about us talking about the media negatively when we're doing our job.
Oh, he's feeding his base. That's what they want. That's what they like. To them, the only real news outlet is Fox News and some far right blogs, and everybody else is just liars. I mean, didn't the president go so far as to call the New York Times traitors?
Treasonous.
So they were treasonous.
Very strong term.
But the editor of the New York Times wrote that op-ed and spoke out and said, hey, no, this, you're going down a dangerous territory. And this is something I think, Melissa, we as a media have to continue to speak out and say this is wrong. And hopefully people will see that and not attack the media for doing their job.
It does increase the potential dangers for journalists to constantly refer to them as the enemy of the people. And let me just say that the vast majority of journalists in this country take seriously their role as serving the public, reporting the facts as best they can, trying to be as fair as they can. And that is a bedrock of this country.
We also have
a free and robust press.
We have to make darn sure that we check our facts, though, so that we have a defense for someone who comes up against us and says fake news. And we can show the paperwork, we can show the sourcing, and we make sure that it is fair and balanced. I hate to use that phrase. When we print, when we go out on the internet, when we go live on air. Period.
And the gentleman did say he was sorry. Mm-hmm. And supposedly in the article, it says that the man may have had a bit too much to drink. So I guess alcohol and politics don't mix.
Did you watch the video? I don't think he realized when he first knocked the phone out of the guy's hand that it was a journalist's cell phone. True. I think he was just being belligerent. But yeah, but all of that said, let's go to a few calls right now. Daryl is in St. Augustine. Hi, Daryl. Good morning.
Yeah, make America hate again. That's what Donald Trump does. I really don't see. It's not a far shot from here to bonesaws. I'm so proud of you, journalists. Keep doing the job that you do. Keep standing up for facts and truth.
Thanks, Daryl. That's what we do. Jack in Fernandina Beach. Hi, Jack. How are you?
Hey. Good morning. Just wanted to say hats off to Orlando, as they were smart enough or savvy enough to make Trump pay for the use of the arena in advance. It's my understanding that he has stiffed several other cities where he's had these events where he hasn't paid the rent for the use of the facility. So hats off to Orlando.
Okay, thanks for that, Jack. Yeah, I mean, that is true. The president has a longstanding reputation of not paying vendors. Before he became president and during the presidency.
He owes about $1 million, I think, nationwide for event security and other things associated with campaign rallies.
Bill at the beaches. Hi, Bill. Good morning to you.
Yes, the problem, it seems to me, is that opinion and news have merged, and no one can make the distinction. And that is the problem. And if you go almost on any channel, everybody's got a bias, no matter the channel that you turn to. It confuses the person who's watching. You don't know if he's watching opinion or real news. And I'll take your comments off the air.
Thank you for that, Bill. And certainly cable news has contributed greatly to that. Let me just make a totally shameless plug for our organization here. NPR and PBS remain the most trusted media brands in America. And so selfishly, I hope people listen to our radio station and watch programs like the PBS NewsHour at night, because I think they do a great job of giving you straight news. Yes. That said, he is right about the way cable news in particular has become extremely partisan and weaponized to benefit political interests.
And there's a lot of gray area there, because a lot of these opinion people are, they come from a journalistic background. It's kind of like how beat reporters end up working on the editorial page. So they are putting forth an opinion, but in their mind, it's an opinion that is informed by facts and informed by research. Now, the situation in Orlando was almost predictable, because there was a blogger downstate. I won't give him any credit, but he put out a list of fake news liberal media journalists that were going to be attending the Trump rally, including two from my friends at the Orlando Weekly, and encouraged his followers to yell fake news at them, blah, blah, blah. And that causes problems. You know, I know in my life, I've been knocked out, I've been spit at, I've had knives and guns pulled on me. None of this had to do with my work, but still, it's a thing that people in the media, have to face up to. This is a situation that's ratcheting up. And as we move into this 2020 election, I guarantee you we're going to see something awful happen on video. Hopefully no one gets killed, but there will be violence at one of these rallies.
And it's important. And it, like I said, this could end badly. But, you know, it's important, too, for people to make their own judgment. Of course, listen to what is being said. And that's important when someone makes a soundbite, when they're making whatever they're saying, listen. And then, therefore, if you listen, you'd be able to make those, you know, those judgments. And of course, it's our job as journalists to pull that out, to tell the truth. And you're right, Melissa. I think majority of us who are doing this job are doing it the right way, and they're pulling out the facts. But if someone says that, if Claire goes around and says, "Oh, Melissa, your hair looks bad today," and no, and she says that,
it looks good.
But I'm just saying, if she says it and you know what, and she said it, and you come back and Dan tries to put it in the way, that's what she said. And if that's what she said,
Another thing I think to be concerned about going into this election cycle are what are now being termed deep fake videos.
Mm-hmm.
They will look completely real.
Those are awful. Mm-hmm.
And you will think that it's like, say, Donald Trump or Barack Obama or whoever it is, Nancy Pelosi, is saying something on camera, and it's completely computer generated. It's not real.
That's bad.
The weaponization of those kinds of videos, particularly on social media, is already happening, and it's going to intensify. So what I would say to everyone out there is, be cautious and double check sources of information.
Yeah. And look at multiple sources. It's no longer an era where you can just depend on one particular news source. We don't have, Walter Cronkite's gone, Peter Jennings, Tom Brokaw, they're gone. Dan Rather's still around, but he's not on TV. You have to look at multiple sources. And something Noam Chomsky used to always suggest when talking about how he would research matters of foreign policy and war is he would look at multiple sources along the spectrum and look for those specific data points where the sources agree. That's where you can sort of center yourself in terms of the facts. And then from there, you can sort of flesh it out with in terms of your own opinions.
And, for what it's worth, a newspaper website like the Times Union or a print product, you can tell the difference. A column is opinion. Our editorial writers is opinion, educated opinion. If you see a byline, no header, no SIG photo with us smiling at you, that is usually a news story. I have a Saturday traffic column. That is a little more fun for me. I present facts. It's not opinion. I present facts. When I do my cop stuff, as pure fact as I can get it, and you know by looking at it, and you can do this on a legitimate news website, you can tell the difference.
That's right.
And if you're quoting it, you're using the quotes that come from people.
Yes.
And
let me drop one more fact on you guys. Of course, it refers to the strange, bizarre, and ridiculous from the week around the state. Luckily, there is never a shortage of material. Here it is for you right now. Only in Florida, the gator edition.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow.
Only in Florida would a massive gator wander onto a major interstate. Did you see this? A massive 12-foot, 463-pound gator just walked onto I-10 near Tallahassee around midnight, causing panic and temporary road closures. The gator wrangler who grabbed this one said it's the biggest he's seen in years.
Speed bump.
A semi-truck reportedly ran over the gator's snout, but that only made it mad. No word on why this gator was trying to cross the road. Can you imagine driving along and all of a sudden slamming on your brakes because a gator that literally weighed almost 500 pounds was right in front of you?
Today in a game of chicken with the gator.
Wow. Why did the gator cross the road?
It's mating season.
We could use that gator in Gainesville because the team is looking bad. But I'm
thank you, Angela, Shelton, Claire, and Dan.
Sure.
Thanks for being here.
Happy Friday.
Up next, we're celebrating International Yoga Day. Yes, that'll calm you down from a gator sighting. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Back in a moment.
Florida State University is a preeminent institution. FSU license plates support scholarships for deserving students who enrich and contribute to our state and nation. Gifts for first-time buyers are online at fsu.edu/mytag.
Wayne Hogan of the Tara Hogan Law Firm.
I'm Wayne Hogan.
A company's cell phone policy can protect your employees and your bottom line. Our distracted driving presentation for the workforce can help.
Learn more at waynehogan.law.
On the next Fresh Air, our interview with John Prine. He was inducted into the Songwriters Hall of Fame last week. Prine's first album came out in 1971 when he was just 24 and working as a mailman. But several of those songs became classics, including Angel from Montgomery, Sam Stone, and Paradise. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 on 89.9 WJCT.
I'm Ira Flatow. This week on Science Friday, we take a trip to Colorado for a look into the secrets of wildfire smoke and the people who chase it, plus a treasure hunt for Colorado's historic heirloom apple trees and the climate-threatened life of the pika. Never heard of one? You will on the next Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
This afternoon at 3 here on 89.9 WJCT.
Iran says it will not wage war, and America says it's not looking for one. But events on and above the Strait of Hormuz tell a different story. Hong Kong's chief executive apologizes after millions protest. Behind the scenes, did Beijing back down? It's the Friday News Roundup, next time on 1A.
Today at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, it's the first day of summer, so here comes the sun as we get ready for a very long day and longer days in general. At the same time, Jacksonville is saying namaste today because it's also International Yoga Day. Catherine Thomas is the founder of Yoga for Change. She's here now with more. Hey, good morning.
Thank you, Melissa. It's great to be here.
And happy summer solstice. So what's happening today to celebrate yoga here on the First Coast?
Well, today is International Yoga Day, and we have a class tonight in downtown San Marco, Rain location at Good Dough, to celebrate yoga and how it makes us feel. So that's what we're up to.
I love yoga, full disclosure. It makes me feel great.
Good.
Yoga is an incredible therapeutic resource for millions of people around the world. Hence, International Yoga Day.
Mm-hmm.
There are some incredible benefits. Tell us a little bit about how Yoga for Change harnesses the benefits of yoga to help people.
Well, we actually just finished a study, a quantitative and qualitative study in partnership with Boston University on our correctional programming. And what we found was it increases post-traumatic growth, emotional awareness and regulation, as well as health benefits. So the program, because there's a lot of variables, different types of yoga, but what we're studying is actually how we offer it to individuals. And so what we do is help people who are dealing with post-traumatic stress, traumatic, potentially past events, and then allow them to sort of deal with it in a really powerful way.
Tell us about the people you serve with Yoga for Change. You're not just conducting yoga classes around town. You're going into prisons and other places. How did all of this mission grow? You started this charity locally, and it's really grown. Tell me more about that.
So Yoga for Change serves veterans, incarcerated individuals, youth, and those suffering from substance abuse. So that's our mission. And then the community events are ways that we raise funding to ensure that that programming can be sustainable. And we're actually across the state of Florida right now because of the Florida Blue Foundation expanding into Tampa, Orlando, and South Florida to deal with the opioid epidemic.
That's exciting.
It's so exciting.
So Jacksonville's own Yoga for Change is getting statewide.
Yep.
Attention.
Yes, yes. It's great to be able to scale and make sure that people who are teaching yoga can get, you know, subsidized payment to teach it and really affect our students who are struggling with opioid addiction.
The corporation BBVA has recently also selected 19 social entrepreneurs from across the U.S. to participate in their accelerator program. Now, this is designed to help participants like you enhance your operations and impact the lives of more people. You, Catherine Thomas, were selected as one of 19 elite social entrepreneurs across America. So Congratulations to you. How will this program help Yoga for Change?
Well, it's actually helping us create a plan to go nationwide. So it's really great because we have an idea of how we want to do it. And now we have access to the BBVA mentors and advisory team and allowing us to tap into their whole experience of scaling, which we really want to do with Yoga for Change.
With all of that said, on this International Yoga Day, you've got something really special planned.
Yes.
How can people be part of it?
Oh, you should just show up to San Marco, downtown San Marco, around 6:15 p.m. The class will start at 6:30. We have a lot of different partners that we've been able to ensure, you know, are partnering with us that it brings, you know, beneficial to their businesses as well. So Good Dough has been really supportive of us. So it's been really great.
They're providing some donuts.
Yes. Yeah, they're really good. So the Mago and Tahini donut, every sale that donut proceeds go back to Yoga for Change.
How cool is that? So people need to come out tonight to Bayless Park.
Yes.
That is at 1999 San Marco Boulevard. Mm-hmm. That's right off the square, isn't it?
It's the class will be in the square.
It's in the square, rather. Yeah. Okay, so it's the little park in the middle of the San Marco Square.
Yes.
Tonight, come out for International Yoga Day. Bring your yoga mat. This is free.
Yep.
Anyone can participate and do yoga in the square.
Yes.
With Catherine Thomas and Yoga for Change. This local nonprofit is growing by leaps and bounds and is eventually going to be nationwide as they use the power of yoga to heal, working with veterans, people with substance abuse problems, and inside prisons. It is such a genius concept. And so, Catherine, I'm so happy to see all your success.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me on the show. I really appreciate it.
And I hope you get a ton of yogis out there tonight in San Marco.
Thank you.
I'm sure you will.
I hope so.
And by the way, thanks for the donuts.
You're welcome.
She brought us some too.
You're welcome.
We will never turn down donuts from good dough.
Yes.
So see you there. Namaste. Yes.
Thank you.
And that's our show. Thanks for listening. Our producer is the scintillating Heather Schatz. The serene and majestic Michelle Corum always keeps us calm and centered. She is our director. And we always value your feedback. Send emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tune in today at noon for the Florida Roundup as we spend the full hour discussing President Trump's re-election kickoff in Orlando and the strategic importance of Florida in 2020. That's coming up at noon. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. We'll be back at 9 a.m. Monday. Have a great weekend. That's when I had most of my fun day. High, 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 high day. Them summer days, oh, summer days. I cried nine when I want to. Out of school, yeah. County fair in the country sun.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.